Where Murder Meets Mystery contains graphic and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, ghoul friends. Let's take a walk down the street where Murder Meets Mystery, a podcast exploring the murderous, the mysterious, and everything that lies beyond the beyond. I'm Grace.
And I'm Beyond the Beyond, Trevor.
Beyond. Where our new podcast is called Beyond the Beyond.
Yes.
It's like our, oh, it's like The Talking Dead.
Yeah, Infinity, you know? And Beyond.
No, that's the Buzz Lightyear podcast.
Yeah, well,
stolen. So, stolen. Cop that. Trev, yep. And I just talked off the record, about our weekend, so I guess we can kind of recap.
No,
usually we talk about it like on air, but we didn't do that this time. So we can talk. We can kind of recap it. So Trev, yeah. What'd you do?
Me and Scar went and visited some friends. Shout out to Haley and William if they listen. I told them about the podcast. So hopefully we'll have some new ghoul friends. But so we just fun. Hung around and ate good food and drank some beers and walked all over the place. It was great. I walked like 8 miles on Saturday. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a great city for walking. Like they've got, it's a very walkable city, I would say. Although people say that about every city. That's very walkable.
Every city is walkable if you have to.
Yeah, that's that's a good point.
If you don't have a car.
Over the weekend, I went to Trev and I do trivia every week, as we've mentioned, and Marissa is on our team, my former co-host, and now beloved ghoul friend. Went to the DJ who does trivia through a release party. I don't know if he's a DJ. Would you say he's a DJ? Comedian?
Trivia master?
Trivia master.
Trivia host?
Fatty McBigballs.
Yeah, his name is Fatty McBigballs.
A.K.A. Brian. Hey, Brian. I know you're listening, bud. He's like 40 episodes behind, he said.
Shout out to Fatty McBigballs.
Yeah, shout out to Fatty McBigballs. You'll hear this next year, probably. But he threw an awesome release party for his trivia book. Amazing. It was such a blast. And we went and did that, and it was really fun. So
yeah, we didn't get to go because we'd already had this trip to see our friends planned, but I would have so totally been there. It would have been so cool.
I know. It was so much fun. We'll have to tell him to throw another party because that was a lot of fun.
And encore.
There was so much alcohol.
He's a theater nerd.
Yes, an encore. Yes, of course. Or he'll say the curtains have closed on the party.
Yeah, he'll definitely say something witty but cringe.
Yeah, we were the youngest people. I told Trevor we were the youngest people there by at least 20 years, I would say.
Which is not a bad thing. It's kind of how it is
at trivia.
No, it's
not a bad
thing.
It was fun.
Well,
yeah,
there's
it's so
been
true.
Some younger people that have come.
Okay, but, you know that one team, like so-and-so and the Zits? They were there, and they're 20. They're in their 20s.
Oh, yeah. So
all
so
the
you,
Zits came
so you
by.
Lied to me.
I did lie to you. Well, they stopped like after.
You're like, we were the only young people there. Not well, except for these other NPC characters. Like, what?
Well, they came by like halfway through and they stayed for like 30 minutes, I think.
Oh, okay.
And then I guess Quiz in My Pants was there too, but they're slightly older than us. I think they're like between us and Fatty. Like they're like in their 30s maybe. Yeah.
So yeah,
anyway.
Girlfriends. I don't know if we talked about it before, but I think Grace kind of alluded to it, but yeah, we play trivia every Tuesday.
Yeah. Our name is See You Next Tuesday.
Yeah, see you next Tuesday because it's every Tuesday.
It was really funny because we explained it. There was this photographer there, and at the guy whose house it was, he was doing it as kind of like a pop-up gallery also. Like, so during the party, one of his friends who's a photographer was selling all of his photography and his artwork like around the house. And the guy had all of the paintings hung up, and like it was so cool. So you could like, and he sold a lot of his art while the party was going on. It was a fun idea. But the photographer, we were explaining the name to him because he was like, what's your team name? We said, see you next Tuesday. And he goes, oh, very clever. And his girlfriend was like, I don't get it. And he like whispered in her ear. And she was like, she goes, oh, my.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my.
Oh, my. Yeah.
Anyway, so, yep. We are fucking dominating at trivia every week. Maybe. Yeah. Medium dominating.
Yeah, we usually do. We do pretty well.
We've won a few times. Second place is our sweet spot, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, look, so crazy weekend. Lots of fun.
Yep, yep.
Both got into it. So, speaking of getting into it, Trev.
Okay, what are we getting into?
You ready to go?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hell yeah. Guys, I have the coolest... That was the wrong choice of words. It's not a cool story by any means. I have the craziest story for you. This is super sad, just like heads up, but it is fucking wild. And I'm reading a book right now by Lisa Wingate called Before We Were Yours. And it was like a New York Times bestseller, which, by the way, I don't really know if that title means anything because I feel like every book is a New York Times bestseller. Maybe not.
Yeah, yeah. Or what is like a Pulitzer Prize? Or is it just like
that's
nonfiction?
Something else. I think that's for journalism.
Oh,
isn't it?
Okay. Yeah, anyway, I don't know.
No, that's the Peabody Prize is for journalism. I don't know. I don't know. Whatever.
It's, the New York if you Times got a book, it's good.
There's a lot of books on the bestseller list, but I think what the claim to fame is like the number of weeks you've been on the bestseller list, I think is like indicates how well the book is selling.
Yeah, it's like an album going platinum or being number one on the charts.
Exactly. Correct. Yeah. So anyway, her book is called Before We Were Yours, and it's a historical fiction novel about these children, five children, siblings, who get abducted from their riverboat house during like the Depression era. And then kind of takes place over a number of years. And so I was just like blown away by this story, and I was like, I decided to look into it, and it turns out it's based on a true story that's even crazier than I thought. And I haven't finished the book, but like I've now investigated the story behind this book.
Yeah.
And this is based on a very real scandal. So I'm going to kind of get into it. Now, to begin our story, I'll relay a personal account given to Commercial Appeal, which is an online publication, by a woman named Teresa Jennings, as the story was told to her by her adoptive parents. So this is the story that she was told growing up. Okay. In the late 1940s, Teresa's parents, like many couples who wanted to start a family but couldn't for various reasons, began to consider adoption. This is what brought them to the doors of the Tennessee Children's Home Society and Adoption Agency in 1947. Teresa was at the time just 13 days old. A tall, older woman with gray hair and glasses and a warm smile greeted her parents at the door. So this is before they adopted Teresa. Is that clear?
Yeah, yeah. She's like 13. She's a newborn, basically.
Yes, she's a newborn, 13 days old. Her parents are arriving at the children's home where she's being housed.
Yeah, she knew. She fresh.
Right. The fresh ones. What did you say? Yeah. What did you called them the slick ones? What did you say?
I don't know.
Cheesy. I don't know. You said something disgusting about little babies. I don't remember what it was. Okay. Anyway, a tall, older woman with gray hair and glasses and a warm smile greets them at the door, holding a little baby boy in her arms. She offers the baby boy to them and speaks highly of his temperament and what were sure to be handsome features. The baby had blonde hair, blue eyes.
Cool.
In the middle of the woman's sales pitch, I'll call it, Teresa's father became certain that he heard a baby crying softly over the woman's shoulder in another room and insisted he be let in to look at the other kids. He and his wife walked into the children's home to find baby Teresa crying quietly in her crib. She was crying so softly because her tongue was swollen dramatically and she was covered in a scaly rash.
All right.
Teresa's parents adopted her on the spot and took her to the hospital to get care, and then she went on to live a long, happy life and tell this story. Now, I'll talk about why it's significant. The children in many children's homes like this one that popped up in the Depression era All these children were in need of parents. They were either orphans or abandoned, or their parents were unable to care for them for some reason or another. But what if I told you that the cheery woman at the door had stolen the baby boy in her arms? What if I told you that she had stolen Teresa as well, and that they were not the only ones, not by a long shot?
Oh, she's a baby taker.
From 1924 to 1950, a woman
baby named... snatcher. Sorry. Definite baby snatcher.
Definite baby snatcher. That's a DJ name for sure.
Yeah.
From 1924 to 1950, a woman named Georgia Tan spearheaded an operation and adoption agency known as the Tennessee Children's Home Society. The society stole over 5,000 children from their families, most of whom were poor and in need, and sold them to the highest bidder. The Tennessee Children's Home Society would become one of the largest infant and child trafficking rings in U.S. history, and was backed by the police, various low-level government agencies, and the state of Tennessee.
Jeez. So backed by them? Like, supported?
So supported financially. Now, whether or not the government was, like, knew the nature of what was going on is not not known.
But the guise of it being, like, a society trying to, like, be, like, an adoption agency, a children's home. Yeah,
and there's like a there's an element of race involved here and white supremacy in terms of, you know, she and her cohorts were taking children that she believed with the most desirable features, aka blonde hair, blue eye, white babies, right?
Right.
And giving them to better homes, aiding in the evolution of superior white individuals.
Eugenics, basically.
Yes, correct.
Taking these children from poor white families that may have desirable features and giving them to rich white families in order for them to have a better life.
Correct.
Or a better chance of living.
And thus gaining more power in society. It's a system. So this was kind of this, there's that kind of like gross underbelly of it, of an already horrific thing that's happening.
Super strange.
Yeah. So
them's the times.
I guess Lisa Wingate, who's the author of the novel I was telling you about, depicts in her book the kidnapping of five children from a poor river shanty town, an accurate portrayal of what was going on during this time of the Depression era. Wingate says, quote, maybe you're a farmer who has lost your farm because of the Depression, or maybe you've lost your job, or maybe your husband has run out on you. You go to the free milk and bread clinic. The people are very nice to you and have you read some forms. You leave thinking all your problems have been solved, but you've just been spotted by a doctor, a nurse, a social worker. You have just crossed the radar of Georgia Tan and the Tennessee Children's Home Society. One day soon, you will turn around and your children will be gone. If you even have the resources to go to court and fight to get them back, you will be told flatly they've been given to people who can give them much more than you can. Children disappeared from yards, porches, little shack homes. Whole groups of siblings vanished as they were walking home from school. Newborn babies began disappearing from hospitals.
Wow.
Several prominent...
Just whatever they deemed was poor enough, they just took.
Yeah. Several prominent movie stars of the time, including Joan Crawford, who, if you've heard of, have you heard of the movie Mommy Dearest?
Yeah.
It's about Joan Crawford. It's based on a memoir by her daughter, Christina Crawford, who wrote about her mother, who was emotionally abusive and an alcoholic. And the book is called Mommy Dearest, and then was turned into a movie.
No More Wire Hangers.
Faye Dunaway. But yeah, No More Wire Hangers, exactly.
It's like a famous quote.
Joan Crawford actually adopted not Christina, but her twin siblings from the Tennessee Children's Home Society. And a number of other movie stars, and we'll talk about how the children would cross state lines. We'll talk about that as well. But a number of other movie stars, as well as there was a professional wrestler, were either Tan babies or obtained Tan babies and found out, like they found out decades later, maybe they were even a Tan baby. So,
dang.
One woman named Sally Brandon was just 3.5 years old when her mother actually gave her and her two brothers to Georgia Tan. Her mother had a hard time feeding the family following the death of Sally's father, Sally recalls one day when her mother dropped her and her brothers off on the steps of the courthouse. Quote, a big black limousine pulled up and this smiling lady gets out and says, come with me. Ugh. Sally and her brothers were brought back to Memphis, where the Tennessee Children's Home was located. There they were split up. Sally recalls meet and greets with prospective parents, recounting that some of the children would come back and some wouldn't. Sally wouldn't see her brothers again for more than 40 years.
Yeah, no, that's wild.
Yeah. In 1996, the adoption records through the Tennessee Children's Home Society became public record, and many families were actually reunited, which was cool.
Yeah, that is cool. I always hate that, like, sometimes they split up families in that, in those cases. Yeah. Like,
oh, for sure.
Brothers and sisters. It's very common. Sent to different families. I honestly think that's kind of like a shame. Like, especially I don't know.
In foster care.
Yeah.
It is true that many children from these homes needed a better life, but the parents who would come to adopt them had no idea where these children had truly come from. A little background information before we continue. So I'm going to kind of talk about the rise of the Tennessee Children's Home Society and how Georgia Tan came to do what she did.
Okay.
After graduating from university, Georgia Tan sought a career as a social worker, but only practiced for a short time before switching gears. She found a job at the Mississippi Children's Home Society, working as the receiving director at the Kate McWillie Powers Receiving Home for Children, where she was soon terminated because of her, quote, questionable child placing methods. I'm not sure. Right. If I had to guess, I mean, when they say placement, they're talking about, like, picking where the children end up.
Right.
And so I don't know if that's – but it says methods, so I'm not really sure what that means. But either way, she was fired. She moved to Memphis, Tennessee, where she was hired as the executive secretary at the Shelby County branch of the Tennessee Children's Home Society. The society was the largest in the state and had branches in Jackson, Knoxville, and Chattanooga. Tan eventually took over the organization later that year, and that was when she began trafficking children. From Wikipedia, while Tennessee law permitted agencies to place children with appropriate applicants, in an effort to ban the selling of children, agencies could charge only for their services. In keeping with the law, the society charged about $7 for adoptions within Tennessee. However, Tan also arranged for out-of-state private adoptions for which she charged a premium. As many as 80% of these adoptions were to parents in New York and California. Adoptions in states such as Mississippi, Arkansas, and Missouri could be arranged for $750, which is a fortune at the time. Right. Records indicate that between 1940 and 1950, the agency placed 3,000 children in just those two states.
Dang. So they were hustling.
Yeah. So what, just to kind of explain that, when you pay for an adoption, you're not paying for the child, because that's buying a human and that's trafficking.
Right.
You're paying for the services and to process the paperwork and, like, the care of the child until it's in your care. That's kind of what you're paying for. There are just a number of things that you're paying for other than the child itself. But what Georgia Tan was doing was charging for the child itself, as well as children with more desirable characteristics, aka blonde hair, blue eyes, pale skin, she charged a premium for those, as well as, like, depending on how wealthy the clients were, that kind of thing. Two women named Alma Walton and Regina Warner both worked for Georgia during this time, and they made trips from the Tennessee Children's Home Society every 3 weeks, delivering an average of 4 to 6 babies per trip to waiting parents in New York and California.
Dang.
So she had a number of people doing her bidding and working at the house. This was a massive operation. This was not just her.
Right.
And this requires money, right? And I'll talk a little bit about some of the donations in a second. In addition to adoption fees and out-of-state premiums, Tan charged exorbitant prices for a number of add-on services, including background checks she never conducted, air travel, and adoption paperwork at up to 5 times the typical price. The state of Tennessee was backing this operation, whether they knew the true nature and scope of Tan's monstrous actions, we may never know, but they contributed around $61,000 per year to the agency, with 31% going to the Memphis branch, headed by Georgia. Now, for those of you wondering, I did calculate the inflation. $61,000 per year So that's Georgia Tan and the Tennessee Children's Home Society were receiving approximately $1,038,784.69 per year in today's money from the state of Tennessee.
Dang.
Yeah. Every penny of these donations going to the agency were kept under a false corporation name. And it's estimated that 80 to 90% of the revenue from these adoptions would line Georgia's pockets for personal use. So she was actually skimming money from the profits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're getting rich off of taxpayers' money.
Right. And also because it was all filed, or it was all under a false corporation, she was then failing to report that income to the IRS. So there was also tax evasion and tax fraud.
Dang.
Tan used a number of ruses to obtain children, often bribing, scamming, or threatening single or struggling parents with legal action. Alma Sipple, one of Tan's many victims, described her as a, quote, stern-looking woman with close-cropped gray hair, round wireless glasses, and an air of utter authority. Through her vast network of powerful connections, Tan also procured a number of children born to patients of Tennessee mental institutions and those born to wards of the state. It was when her services were met with an unprecedented demand that Tan then resorted to kidnapping, often from poor areas and shanty towns, hospitals, as well as a series of homes for unwed mothers in Memphis.
Mm.
Tan was documented taking children born to unwed mothers at birth, claiming that the newborns required medical care. When the mothers later asked after the children, Tan and her accomplices would explain that the babies had died when they had actually been placed in foster homes or adopted to other families.
Dang.
Isn't that sad?
That's awful.
Yeah. She destroyed records of children adopted through the society, and if adoptive parents expressed concern about false information given to them about a child, as in she maybe advertised the child differently than the child actually ended up, right? That's what they mean by false information. Right. Tan threatened legal action lest they surrender their child back to her care. So like she's basically like, either drop the accusations or I'll sue you and take your child. All of Tan's illicit activity and legal threats were backed by Shelby County Family Court Judge Camille Kelly, who pushed the cases through when Tan claimed these children were lacking proper care and should thus be given to her. In other words, if adoptive parents filed official complaints against Georgia Tan, they would all go through this family court judge, Camille Kelly, who then would push the cases through. Now they later realized she was being bribed by Georgia.
Right, right. She had the judge in her pocket to where no one could argue otherwise.
Yeah. And so she was pushing these cases through saying, no, Georgia Tan is providing these children with better care than they were otherwise getting.
Right.
In a letter drafted in 1947, Tan's attorney, Abe Waldauer, said that the prospective adoptive couple had, quote, complete custody and control of a child for 1 year, may submit the child to any physical or mental examination they wish, and take any steps they may desire to ascertain they have a healthy and normal child. If it is not, the Tennessee Children's Home takes it back without question.
Okay.
But, like, that has so many implications that freak me out. Like, basically saying, like, these parents... You can inspect this child in any way you want to and put it to any test. And if it doesn't hold up to your expectations, the home will take it back. But that's not necessarily better. You know what I mean?
It's your money back guarantee, man.
Yeah. It's just like fucking gross. Okay.
If they walk funny or crawl funny, send them back.
One thing I mentioned earlier about the background checks, about how she was like charging exorbitant fees for the background checks, but never actually conducting them.
Right.
This had obvious negative implications as well, because adoptive parents are supposed to go through rigorous background checks.
Right.
Because you're taking a kid from potentially a bad situation and putting them into a worse situation, right? If you don't thoroughly inspect the background of these parents. And she wasn't.
You don't want it
to
be like a felon or like a potential pedophile or something like that.
Exactly.
It'd be awful. They may have the cash or the scratch to do it, but just because someone's has the money and the means to do it doesn't mean that they have the best intentions.
Correct. And so like she wasn't even checking these backgrounds. So then you were getting situations where kids were being put into abusive situations.
Right.
Not that it was much better than the children's home. And I'll talk about that. One of the reasons why Tan was able to orchestrate this trafficking ring for so long was with the financial and political backing of her network of prominent figures. Tan also had connections with former Memphis, Tennessee Mayor E.H. Crump, who continued to have an influential political presence until his death. He had long been known to take bribes from unlawful establishments, e.g. brothels and gambling halls, a fact which Tan used to her advantage. So she was blackmailing him is the implication.
Yeah.
She enjoyed a lavish lifestyle and was widely respected in the community, counting among her friends prominent families, politicians, and legislators.
Yeah, like other than blackmail, why is her company just so much more popular with people who have influence? Like, was she just really good at like blackmailing people, or were people using these children as a means to fulfill some like nasty desires that they have, but they just happen to also hold power and offices which she could also like blackmail them for? I don't know.
Truthfully, or, like, would she
bribe them with the sheer amount of money that she was making as well?
I think that she didn't have that amount of money to begin with, but the giving the children up, like initially she was persuading poor families to give their children to her. So like I mentioned, like it wasn't until the demand like saw that like meteoric rise that she really started abducting, as far as we know. But up until then, she had been persuading these families to hand over the children to her and then giving them to wealthy families, which is, I imagine, by word of mouth is like how she initially grew her business, really.
Yeah, because if there's a wealthy family that has trouble having kids, then that wealthy family tells another wealthy family, or they're like, did you hear about the Joneses? They got their, they adopted a kid from this place and it was like the perfect kid or whatever.
And as we know,
disgusting as that is,
in the way that our country is, almost anyone who's in office or a politician has enormous amounts of money, right? You have to be wealthy to run for any kind of office. If I had to guess, I think that's why. I think that's how she built her network, is she was either giving children to people in politics or just building this network with the wealthy, with the elite of Memphis and beyond, right? And beyond the beyond. New York, California, and then once she started selling children to celebrities, it was just like it multiplied from there.
Okay.
Yeah. Even more tragic than the countless abductions is the treatment of many children under Tan's care. Reports of neglect, physical and sexual abuse, and even murder came from the home. The society would eventually move to a mansion located at 1556 Poplar Avenue. The large home was donated to the agency by a wealthy businessman in 1943, but prior to this, the agency and the many children under Tan's care did not have proper facilities, and the children were often awaiting placement in public homes or foster homes. Quote, the all-female staff wore all-white nursing uniforms, despite the fact that they were mostly untrained and even substance abusers. The children were frequently sedated, and those who were difficult to place were allowed to die of malnutrition. It's kind of like the eugenics. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Tan regularly ignored doctors' recommendations for sick children, denying them care or medicine, which often led to preventable deaths from illnesses such as diarrhea. Which, in that case, like, diarrhea at that young of an age can be really dangerous because you can get dehydrated really quickly.
Yeah, no. It's definitely not the correct standard of care that a orphanage needs to have. And
it
seems like she didn't really care to hire anybody that was actually remotely qualified, but would dress them up like they were.
And I think that the implication too of allowing the children to die of malnutrition, what's implied there is it's not just the children who were difficult to place. I think that that means the children with undesirable characteristics. I think that that's what that means.
Oh, right.
Or like they maybe they were unruly or like badly behaved or whatever, you know.
Could be behavior. It could be whatever it is that keeps them from getting adopted immediately. They then now say, well, okay, since you're a bad product, essentially, they're just going to let you die, which is terrible. But
exactly. Many of Georgia Tan's known victims are buried in Elmwood Cemetery in Memphis, Tennessee, but so many were never accounted for. Estimates place the number of children who died due to mistreatment under Tan's care at around 500.
Dang.
Quote, at the time, so-called black market adoptions were not illegal, but were considered ethically and morally wrong. Reasons of the day included the fact that young unwed mothers were often coerced to give up wanted children. The suitability of the parents was often ignored. Information about the child's heritage and medical history was lost, and adoptive parents were unaware of any physical or mental illness.
Yeah, no, that's crazy.
The Tennessee governor of the time, Gordon Browning, launched an investigation into the society on September 11, 1950, after receiving reports that the agency was selling children for profit. 2 days later, the story was published nationwide through the New York Times and commercial... What was it? I said it earlier.
Well, hold that thought. I have a little story. This is almost kind of strikes me as like how hard it is to adopt like a foreign child or whatever, or someone someone from my church was trying to adopt a Chinese orphan, and so they went over to see through the orphanage to see her and to adopt her, but like later on there's so many hoops that they have to jump through and background checks that the government of China has to like do in order for you to basically take this child out of poverty, out of a situation where they are malnourished, are not necessarily taken care of, are not educated, and then, you know, brought to America. In that point, it should be like just such a stark difference in care. But not only that, you have to jump all through all these hoops. It's like 40 grand to like adopt these children. Like there's such a big paywall of like, and all that money doesn't even go to the orphanage or doesn't even go to like the kids for better care. It's just like straight back into the government. So it's like government's just like playing on the heartstrings of foreigners.
Yeah.
And then just like, time to cough up 40 grand.
Yeah.
It's like a similar situation to this. It's that's like not just to treating mention the people as like products.
And that's not to mention the, you know, the foster care system in the United States and like all these misplaced children who are, you know, looking for homes, may never have them because adoption is an expensive process, even if you're not adopting a child overseas. Like it's expensive. And it really is like this. I think that this was not what the part of this that was not unusual is that adoption is reserved for the elite. It really is.
Yeah.
Because you have to, or at least the upper middle class, I mean, you have to have a certain level, a certain amount of money, and they have to inspect also like how financially secure is the home? Is it not just do you have the money to adopt the child? It's do you have the money to give this child a better life and care for it for an extensive period of time?
Right. And because like it's hard and it needs to be extensive, but what you're really trying to find is a pair of parents or guardians or whoever it is that will love and take care of the child. And like the many ways that they try to do that through like financial reasons may not necessarily make sense, but like it needs to be extensive but not so expensive. Like I don't understand. But because of the like paperwork that they have to do and all this stuff that you have to file and get done and court things maybe red or tape. Just like government red tape, it just creates so many more financial hoops to jump through.
It's sad. It really is.
Just like before you tried to adopt them, they might have been all right, but
It's 5 grand. Family
might not be in good shape.
It's a double-edged sword, I think, because you've got, on one hand, you want it to be a relatively easy process because you want these children to find homes. There are so many children without homes, but then you don't want it to be too easy because then just anybody can adopt a child, and that's asking for trouble.
That's not good. Yeah.
Right. So anyway. So 2 days after the Tennessee governor launches this investigation, the story is published nationwide and becomes a media sensation or newspaper sensation, I should say.
Yeah.
The public welfare commissioner officially accused Tan and her cohorts of receiving as much as $1 million in profits. The Tennessee Children's Home Society was closed officially in 1950. And the state of Tennessee sued Tan's estate for $500,000, which they, I mean, I feel like they could have sued them for way more. And now if we, as conspiracy theorists, operate under the assumption that the state of Tennessee did in fact know that it was a child trafficking ring and not just an adoption agency, it's not shocking that they sue her for such a small amount. Like, maybe it's just for appearances. I don't know.
Right.
You know?
Well, and it's such a large amount of money for that time. But correct. No one necessarily, like, the article said that she might have, you know, saw $1 million in profit, but that's also probably alleged. Like, she might have
even had more. And they're also donating $61,000.
Mm-hmm.
So they're essentially, they gave her $61,000 a year for, let's say, 20 years. Okay.
Yeah.
But they only sued her after 20 years of donations. They sued her for $500,000. That's nothing. That's fucking chump change.
Yeah. And that doesn't even count the profit she made.
Right. While New York and California both vowed to take action, the children's adoptions were never investigated, and some children did not learn the circumstances of their adoption until the late 90s when those records became public.
Oh, wow.
Just 3 days before the state filed official charges against the Tennessee Children's Home Society, Georgia Tan died of uterine cancer. She was 59.
Oh, dang.
So she was, they never, she was brought up on charges but never tried.
Did she have any children?
That's a good question. As far as I know, she did not. There was like a rumored romantic relationship she had with a woman, actually, from the Mississippi Children's Home Society. She was rumored to have been romantically involved with a woman, which would have been obviously highly scandalous at that time.
Uh-huh.
Who worked with her or was the daughter of the founder of the Mississippi Children's Home Society, the first place that employed her.
Yeah.
And when she was terminated, there's this rumor that this woman, Ann Atwood, actually moved to Tennessee with Georgia. And then when Ann Atwood died or for some reason was no longer able to care for her children, Georgia took over the care of her children. But I don't think she legally adopted them. They may have just gone into the system, into the network of, I don't know.
Like, this is the house that human trafficking built. Like, I don't know. I wonder what happened to all the money that she had. You know, I wonder what her will was like, is basically what I'm after. But I couldn't
find any evidence other than the Wikipedia page talks about Ann Atwood and like their alleged relationship and like how she took over the care of her children. But right. I couldn't find anything to corroborate that. So I didn't include it in my notes, but technically
maybe it was all seized by the state or something.
There was one report. I don't know. Let's see. For her part in the scandal, Judge Kelly was believed to be receiving bribes for ruling in Tan's favor, but she resigned shortly after the start of the investigation and died in 1955 without any charges having been brought against her. So lucky. If you're keeping track, that is zero people held accountable for what's going on.
Yeah.
Yep. Over the time the society was operational, 19 of the children known to have died as a result of Tan's abuse and neglect were buried in a small lot at the Elmwood Cemetery with no headstones. Tan herself had purchased the lot and recorded the burials of these children under only their first names, i.e. Baby Joseph, Baby Eileen.
Right.
In 2015, Elmwood Cemetery erected a monument to the memory of these children with the inscription, quote, in memory of the 19 children who finally rest here, unmarked, if not unknown, and all of the hundreds who died under the cold, hard hand of the Tennessee Children's Home Society. Their final resting place is unknown. Their final peace is a blessing. The hard lesson of their fate changed adoption procedure and law nationwide.
Yeah. That's awful. Nobody was held accountable. It just happened.
Literally. The scandal resulted in adoption reform laws in Tennessee in 1951, including a law that stops adoption agencies from falsifying birth certificates in an attempt to hide the origins of the child. Yeah, in 1979, the state adopted legislation requiring the state to help adopted siblings attempting to locate one another. But there was an attempt to pass an extension of this provision that would require the state to financially assist parents, like birth parents who were looking for children who had been adopted, but that one didn't pass. So it was just to aid the siblings who were looking for each other.
Gotcha.
In 1996, the state of Tennessee enacted Chapter 532 of the Tennessee Public Acts of 1996, which released adoption records from the Tennessee Children's Home Society to the adult adoptees. So that was when this all kind of like, they started to reunite families and that kind of thing. But this wasn't until 45 years after right. the story broke. Prior to the 1920s, adoption was a rare practice in the United States, with the Boston Children's Aid Society placing only 5 children per year. By contrast, in 1928, TAN placed 206 children with adopted families just in that year alone. Believing in class distinctions, TAN felt that children should be taken from poor families and placed with what she called people of a higher type. Because of TAN's insistence on choosing wealthy adoptive families, the practice of adoption became associated with the famous and the influential, removing much of the stigma it previously had in American culture.
Dang.
Yeah. Isn't that wild?
It is pretty wild. That was a wild ride.
That's it. Mic drop, man.
Nah, that's, I mean, it's terrible in a lot of ways, but so it's also, sad. I guess what you're saying in your last bullet there is like, so it did kind of release the stigma from like orphanages and adopting, because yeah. then it seems like, well, famous people do it, but also that probably paints it in a better light than just like.
But then that adds the additional stigma, because as adoption has become more and more sought after by wealthy families, it's become more expensive. Yeah, and so you have like, you have these families who can afford to give a child a decent life that are not necessarily considered upper class, but mm-hmm. can't afford adoption. And that's fucked, because then you have all these children floating around in the system.
Yeah.
It's sad. It really is. And the whole system is broken, and just, it's like I said, this case is like obviously a mega downer. All the cases are, but this one in particular. But I just thought it was so fascinating. I was like, I have to talk about it. And I know it's not technically cool. Like there were some murders, but like, I know it's not, it's a little out of my lane, but I just thought it was so interesting. So
I think it's interesting too.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty
any questions, comments, queries?
No teacher.
Okay. All right. Some of my students call me teacher. I told you that.
Mm-hmm.
They say teacher, that's, teacher.
That's why I said it.
Yeah. A lot of my students don't speak, English is not their first language. Most of my students speak Mandarin. So they call me teacher, which is actually in Mandarin Chinese, you address a teacher by Lao Shi, which is teacher, and then their surname. So technically my title would be Lao Shi Miller, which is, you know, my last name. And so mm-hmm. they just call me teacher. It's really cute.
That's cute.
And a little cultural lesson.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Yeah. Anyway, so Trev, I'm ready to hear what you got for me, because yeah, we are finally, we're away from the Waco wave.
We are. And I've got something a little bit more fun. And I'm also kind of curious how we haven't done it yet. But of course, I'm talking about freaking Big Dad himself, Bigfoot, Sasquatch.
Hell yeah!
Taking it to Cryptid Town again.
Yeah. Oh my god, I'm gonna have to tell Sean. Yeah, I won't leave his name out because he'll be listening. But he loves Bigfoot. Yeah. I'm so excited. Shout out to Sean.
Yeah.
Shout out to all you ladies out there.
Yeah, all the lady friends. So yeah, we're talking about freaking Big Dad.
All right. And, I'm ready.
Sasquatch boy. Mm-hmm. So, I I'm going to kind of dumb it down.
Of
our beginner girlfriends, who may have never even heard of Bigfoot, which, you know, controversially, Bigfoot I have a note that says, someone's claimed that Bigfoot has as much of an impact in popular culture nowadays as Michael Jordan. Like,
wow.
So, like, people know Michael Jordan, but, like, also people, about as many people know who Bigfoot is. So, like,
that's so funny.
If you've been living under a rock, old friends, Bigfoot is also commonly referred to as Sasquatch and is an ape-like creature said to inhabit the forests of North America.
So, ape-like creature.
Yeah. Wow. You know, made popular by the Jack Links commercials, messing with Sasquatch. Those are always fun. Well, friends, if you don't know who Bigfoot is, we're going to get into it. Okay. So Bigfoot is referred to as Sasquatch. It has many names. Basically, similar descriptions are alleged to inhabit various different regions throughout the world, such as skunk ape, is a good popular name for the southeastern United States, which is where I grew up. So we know all about the skunk ape.
Hell yeah.
The Almas Yeren. Wait,
is that really what they called it where you grew up?
Yeah, skunk apes.
That's so funny.
It's because that's what they smell like. They don't smell good.
Ew. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's weird. I thought Bigfoot smelled like chocolate axe.
That would actually be much worse, I would think, than what he actually smells
like. Much worse. God.
But yeah, in Asia, they call it the Almas Yeren. So it's like, and Yeti as well. Okay. Some of the things that they do, like in the colder regions for
Yeti. Yeti's the same?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought Yeti was the abominable snowman. I thought that was something that was different.
Maybe.
So some Bigfoots are big feet?
Big Sasquatches?
Sean says they're Sasquatch people or something like that. He said like, there's a title. There's a PC term. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I don't know.
But they're like there's like polar versions that live in the Himalayas.
I would imagine they could go wherever they want with those big feet. So
hell yeah, so true.
Call them what you want; they everywhere. Yeah. In Australia, they call it a Yowie, and basically, just like Bigfoot, they're ingrained in like the cultures or the folklore of the region. So you know, Yetis will have different stories, Yowies will have different stories, skunk apes, and the like. You know,
that's so funny. Skunk apes.
Bigfoot is most often described as a large, muscular, bipedal, ape-like creature covered in black, dark brown, or dark reddish hair. And
dark red? Ew. Yeah. That freaks me out.
Thanks. Well, my hair is dark red. So
it's fine. It's not. You're full of shit. It's brown.
No, it says dark reddish hair.
Your beard is reddish. Your head hair is brown.
It's fine. I'm not internalizing the insults. But anyway.
You really look like you are.
I mean, I'm Bigfoot-esque, so.
Oh, that Trev's a gentle giant, though.
Large, muscular, and bipedal ape-like creature. I mean, that's basically what the first line of my resume reads.
My business card.
Yeah.
Oh,
with
man.
With an estimated height of roughly 6 to 9 feet, with some descriptions having the creature standing as tall as 10 to 15 feet, which 6 to 9 feet, I'm just saying, I'm falling in that category.
Yeah,
I could be Bigfoot.
This is checking out so far.
This just in, girlfriends, Bigfoot sighting on the girlfriend podcast. He's eloquent, which might be a stretch, but he could speak. And
he's eloquent.
And he goes by the name Trevor.
I would say you're articulate. I would not say you're eloquent.
So maybe I'm down with the Bigfoot. Maybe I just sympathize with him too much. But
you know what they say about big feet.
Yeah. What do they say, Grace? Go ahead. Yeah. We don't have to say it on our podcast. It doesn't have to be that kind.
Big penis.
No, big penis. She said it. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have any metrics on Bigfoot's member, but I imagine there's multiple sexes of big feet, big fitinas and big fitinos.
Oh, sorry. My fuck. Oh, my God.
But, you know,
Bigfoot's member. That fucking sent me. I'm
sure there's fan fiction out there that you guys could find if you want.
Oh, you know there is. I mean, I told Marissa I was going to start Mothman fan fiction because I fucking love Mothman so much.
There already is.
Mothman's kind of my type. Like
using
what?
His wings as leverage.
Bigfoot. Oh my God. Bigfoot, if you're listening.
How did I know this was going to happen? But yeah.
Oh my God, you totally did. I can
tell. Tall, dark, 15 feet. Large feet. 6 fingers on each hand.
Incredible. Oh my God, like Princess Bride.
Yeah, exactly.
Why the fuck did Christopher Guest, why did he have the audacity to play the six-figured man? That doesn't make any sense.
I don't know. They should have found a six-fingered man.
Yeah, like they gave him that prosthetic glove. You know, that's so dumb. Whatever.
Fuck that. They should have grafted a digit onto his hand.
Hell yeah.
Wear a glove? No. I want a fully articulate
member.
Digit member. Yeah. Yeah, fuck that guy. He didn't go the extra mile. If they would have picked Christian Bale, he would have came out with like extra digits on every limb.
He's a method actor. So I fused this finger onto my hand.
They have to green screen it out of every other movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of green, they got to cut all the fucking gangrene off of his fucking arm from amateur surgery. For fuck's sake. Christian Bale.
I mean, it's Hollywood. I'm not saying we don't have to spend a milli on Christian Bale's hands, but I mean, we could.
He's like, I have six fingers now. They're like, yeah. Where's the sixth one? He's like,
$10 million of the $60 million budget went to grafting digits all over Christian Bale's body. And he was down for it.
You know he was. Christian Bale, you're a freak. I know you are.
How many, what is it, Emmys or Grammys did he win for that performance?
As Who fucking knows?
The six.
As six-dicked man.
The too many
six-membered man.
The too much anatomy man. Just way too much.
We're looking for a man with a six-inch wiener.
Oh.
Oh.
Shouldn't be that hard to find.
What about six wieners? God. We're looking for a man with six members on his right hand.
I think that's an entirely different movie. Just entirely different.
The Princess Ride.
Yeah, it's on a different website. The Princess Ride. Oh my God. Oh, Bigfoot, you've taken us down a dark path.
Daddy's Little Princess Bride.
Oh,
hell
no.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Oh, no, God. Not the Daddy King.
I'd be so good at naming porn. I really would. Because it's all puns. That's all it is.
I think you should reach out to some people and say, I'll hire you.
And OnlyFans, but just for naming porn.
Yeah. There you go.
God. Okay. All right, go ahead.
Hold it down in that space. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Please continue. All right.
Well, you're gonna love this because alleged observations describe Bigfoot as more like man-like. Ooh. With reports of human-like faces.
Ew.
So, you know, he's big and hairy, actually. But when you stare into his eyes, he's just vaguely human-like. So
big and hairy until you stare.
Yeah. And then he just oh, big
bless
one.
You. Wow.
Big sneeze. Timestamp. Anyways.
Sasquatch sneeze.
Yeah. Only Sasquatch's sneeze. Caught me. Caught in 4K.
Oh, yeah.
In 1971, multiple people in the Dales, which is spelled like Dallas with an E, Oregon area, they filed a police report describing an overgrown ape. And one of the men claimed it had sighted the creature in the scope of his rifle, but could not bring himself to shoot it because it looked more human than animal.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It described being man-like. There's you a good anecdote or a real-world application.
It was too human for him to kill it.
Yeah, he just felt bad, man.
Yeah, but if you see any animal walking upright, I would just assume it's a human, not a...
Any animal walking, you know? Oh, like a bipedal, you mean?
Yeah, like because you don't see a bear walking around on two legs. I mean, you see them stand up and whatever.
That's interesting because you could, right? And I'll get into that a little bit more.
But they don't walk around, though. Do they?
I'm sure they could if they
wanted to. Bears, walking around like this.
Yeah, walking around on two legs, you know, trying to swipe at that honey. There it is. Reaching for the honey pot. Yeah. Disgusting term.
Are we still talking about porn?
I don't know. At this point.
There's no telling.
Common descriptions include broad shoulders, no visible neck, and long arms. Which skeptics neck. So they're like Big Ed from 90 Day Fiancé. Which is...
Oh, God. What? No visible neck?
Yeah, he's just like built different.
That's so weird.
Head syndrome.
Man. Okay, please continue. Sorry.
Yeah, alleged nighttime sightings have stated that the creature's eyes glowed yellow or red, which eye shine is not present in humans or in any other known apes. So this is kind of debunked, but they say that like if you're perceiving eye shine at night, could mean that you're perceiving it from like owls, raccoons, or possums, Persian foliage.
Is that what that's called, eye shine?
Yeah, you like
said, you ever, did you just say foliage?
Foliage.
You mean foliage?
Foliage.
What is foliage?
Stanima.
It's aluminum foil.
Stanima.
My sister used to say aminol. Look at all those aminols.
For amniotic fluid?
No, babe. No.
Yeah,
no.
Persian foliage. There we go. I can do it.
There you go.
But yeah, eye shine is like at night. I don't know. You didn't grow up in the woods, I guess. But like when you're driving down the road and you can like look into the woods and you can see like the glare from the headlights.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I just didn't know that's what it was called. Yeah, so like animals other than humans and apes have eye shine?
Yeah. Well, dogs do it a lot. And cats. Yeah, dogs and cats.
Is that why in infrared, when you see a person, their eyes look black instead of glowing?
Oh, I don't know.
You ever seen the Blair Witch Project?
No, but that's probably effects.
Yeah, well, like infrared, when you look at someone infrared. I'm not sure. Yeah, like a human's eyes will look black, or like night vision. They look black, or just really dark. Yeah.
Yeah, because you can flip the color palette on the like infrared to be anything.
Yeah. But like the pupil and iris is all one, as opposed to shining, where like if you look at like a raccoon in night vision,
I think that's what it is for, because like the way infrared works is it's projecting infrared light onto something, so it's like a flashlight, and then it's the camera is catching what.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Science.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome. Oh,
thanks. I know. I'm so glad you were here to tell me that.
Well, you probably knew it already.
I didn't know otherwise.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Welcome to the mansplaining part of the podcast. Shit.
Usually it happens so much earlier.
Hey, Grace, will you just read my notes? Is that fine? I was just reacting to my
own shit. As long as you're there to explain them to me.
Because then I won't sound like a big asshole.
No, it's fine. No, I was just messing with you, Mr. Science. Please continue.
It's okay. Go ahead. Mr. Science is sensitive, but anyway. Michael Rugg with two G's.
Michael Rugg?
The original Rugg.
This is still porn.
He's also the owner... What?
Michael Rugg Muncher.
Oh, I get you.
Oh.
I understand. Carpet, yeah. Okay. Bigfoot fan of the carpet. The owner of the Bigfoot Discovery Museum in Northern California claims to have smelled Bigfoot. So he got a big whiff. And stating that he imagined a skunk that had rolled around in dead animals and just had hung around the garbage pits.
For fuck's sake. So, like, you should be able to smell them a mile away then.
Yeah, I mean, a skunk is bad enough, but one that rolls around in dead animals.
Yeah, god damn.
And hangs around garbage pits. I don't know if that's a distinct smell. Like, is it like apartment garbage, or is it like restaurant garbage, you know? Like, there's layers to that shit, player.
Restaurant garbage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like dying vegetation. What does that sound?
Oh, shit. Can you hear my washing machine?
Yeah, is that what it is? Oh, that's time okay. Stamp. No, it was kind of whimsical. I like it.
It is whimsical. I'm sorry.
It's our theme music. It goes on so long, though.
It does.
Is it like a song that when it's ready?
Yeah.
Aww, so cute.
It's like a German song.
Little folk song.
Yeah, it's
kind of like
creepy.
A cuckoo clock when it's ready, a little Dutch child pops
out. Yeah, because they just didn't think like a buzzer or like a long beep was sufficient. They had to make it sing to you. Like, I don't know why. I don't really know why they did this, but Samsung wild out here wilding with their like chimes. I don't know.
Like Sam Sing. You know what I'm saying?
Sam Sang.
Sam be singing.
Sam just sung to us.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right, I got some more facts. The enormous footprints for which the creature is named can be as large as like 24 inches long and like 8 inches wide. So like 2 feet by like almost a foot. And for reference, the average NBA player's shoe size is size 15, which is only 12 inches long and 4 to 5 inches wide.
Wow.
So it's like more than double like Shaq's feet.
Yeah. More than double.
I would say he's not average, but it's definitely way bigger than Shaq's feet.
But average NBA player. I know what you mean.
Yeah, these would be like putting on your mom's slippers for Shaq, you know, like when you're a kid and you put on your mom's like slippers or shoes or anything. They're just like big giant shoes. And be like, Shaq would put on Bigfoot shoes and be like, God dang.
I feel like your mom's got tiny feet though, because she's a little lady.
Yeah, she does.
Defy some fucking physics, I gotta say. Because Trev's a big guy, big boy.
Right.
And your mom's so little. Like his mom's really petite. And your dad's not that tall. He's like what, 5'10"?
No, he's 6 foot even.
He is?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
He might have shrank. He probably is. He could be like 5'11" now from shrinkage.
Shrinkage. That was my dad was 6'2" at one point. And now he's like 5'10".
It happens.
Yeah.
The constant pull of gravity pulls us closer and closer to the ground.
So true.
Ugh. Our final resting place. Anyway.
Hate it.
A little bit of history on the Big Feet. On the Tule River Indian Reservation in Central California, petroglyphs. Mm-hmm. What's a petroglyph? You know what a petroglyph is?
Something in a rock. Rock writing.
Yeah, like carvings, like cave carvings.
Can I just say how fucking awesome I am? I know I teach English, but I have to say that I didn't know. But because of my knowledge of roots and word prefixes, I figured it out.
I think you deserve a gold star.
Oh. Yeah, that was fucking awesome. Wow.
Yeah. That was so cool. But these petroglyphs were created by a tribe of Yokuts, which is, I guess, just, you know, indigenous people, at a site called Painted Rock. And they're alleged to depict a group of big feet or Bigfoot called the Family. And there's a photo on the drive.
Oh, I've heard of that. Yeah.
There's a photo on the drive.
A?
Under folder A, yep.
Ooh.
And the local tribes people.
Ghosts or some shit.
Yeah, but look at that big one. You see him? the big black one?
Yeah.
Yeah, the local people call that, which is the largest of the glyphs, Hairy Man, and they're estimated to be between 500 and 1,000 years old.
Wow.
Isn't it pretty crazy?
That is pretty crazy.
Describe to them like what's going on, because it's like, it's called the Family, but...
So we've got, I don't know what's going on in the middle, but you've got at least three Sasquatch people, or like the big people. And then they all kind of, they look like swamp monsters is what they look like, where they've got the domed head and like the big, like,
arms. Oh, like almost like they don't have necks.
Yeah, no necks. Correct. And then they've got,
they're kind of swoopy, like with their features, like almost like they're hairy.
It looks like that, like combat camo stuff that they wear, where a ghillie it's like suit. Brass. Yeah, a ghillie suit. That's what it looks like.
No, I know what you mean.
And then you see what I think are warriors in the background, maybe like running to, I guess, slay it. But then there's like this big thing with like a sickle in the middle. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I don't know. But that was mainly what I was getting at. Is like they're kind of reminiscent of what we like to call Bigfoot Sasquatches. So I don't know. It was super cool to see that.
Like a ghillie suit.
It does. It does. I like its eyes.
They're just the glowing eyes. Eye shine.
It's cool. Yeah, apparently. But 16th century Spanish explorers and Mexican settlers in California. Also, remember, in California, so this is kind of a hotbed for sightings of Bigfoot proper and not just skunk ape in other parts of the United States.
Skunk ape. It's so funny.
Told tales of the Los Vigilantes Oscuros, or
the Dark Watchers. Vigilantes. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Large creatures alleged to stalk their camps at night. Another historical recollection in the region that is now known as Mississippi, a French Jesuit priest was living with the Natchez, which is a tribe, in 1721 from the area of Mississippi. They reported stories of hairy creatures in the forest known to scream loudly and steal livestock. Which, in 1721, if something screams loudly and livestock goes missing, I'm out. I'm out of there.
Yeah, fuck that. No, I'm out of here 2022. Yeah. I don't care. 1721.
Right. Yeah. So we're about to go through an area of which I like to call times where I can't pronounce words because we're getting into Native Americans and stuff. Okay. But members of the Lummi, which is another indigenous tribe, so Native American tribe, tell tales about creatures known as Semekoas.
Okay.
The stories are similar to each other in general descriptions of Semekoas, but details among them just kind of differ from each one. So there's various family accounts concerning the creature's diet and activities. Some regional versions tell more of threatening creatures, which they called the Stiyaha or the Kui Kui or something like that.
Okay. Or a
nocturnal race, and children were warned against saying the names so that the monsters would not come and carry them off to be killed. So,
and that was something kind of that like you mentioned folklore. About the skinwalkers as well. Was mm-hmm. like that they couldn't say the name because they believed that the name was doomed.
Right, like, right. And it's not like good to speak of such things. Right.
Yeah.
Just kind of that reverence of like, we don't talk about it because then it'll make it more real.
We don't talk about Bruno. No, no, no.
Yeah, or Bruno will come and carry you off to be killed.
And scream loudly and steal your sheep.
Yeah, the Encanto was the opposite. They talked about Bruno a lot and, you know, still, the same thing. Bruno came back. I
noticed
bet.
The lack of sheep. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Notice the lack of sheep in Encanto. watch it again and count how many sheep there are. And checkmate.
Oh, man.
Checkmate.
Okay.
The Iroquois tell of the aggressive hair-covered giant with rock-hard skin known as Otne Yarhe or Stone Giant, as I more love, commonly referred I to as the Genesqua.
Otne Yarhe.
Yeah. You like the rock hard skin? I knew you would. In 1847, we don't have to talk about it. In 1847, Paul King. Oh, why is my notes turning into just suggestive themes?
It outdoes every week.
It does every week.
Yeah.
Lovely. All right, well, welcome, good friends. Enjoy. Paul Kane reported stories by the natives about skookums. Which is a race of cannibalistic wild men living on the peak of Mount St. Helens in the southern...
Not on the pink.
Yeah. Oh, not they weren't just living on the pink. They ate other things. I mean, the wild men... Listen, the cannibalistic wild men had a diverse diet of cannibalistic things. But they were living on the peak... of Mount St. Helens in southern Washington State. It just so happens they're cannibals and they only eat one thing. Anyway,
they're cannibals.
Yeah, well, oh, that was all by mistake. I didn't talk about cannibals eating the pink, but clearly we're going to get taken away from our fans at this point. I'm sorry, girlfriends.
God, we're going to get demonetized, and that says a lot since we don't make shit off of this.
Yeah, since we don't monetize.
We'll never be sponsored. We're like, why didn't anyone sponsor us? That's why.
Well, girlfriends, there was a sponsor, but it was like some sort of magic mushroom shot that made you work better. And I didn't want to sell that to y'all. If we're going to sell something to you, girlfriends, I'm going to get some sort of like enjoyment from it or something we actually believe.
It was like the eighth week of the podcast that we got offered a sponsorship from this Korean singing competition.
Oh.
And Marissa and I were like, what? And we kept getting emails from them. We were like, what is going on? So I think they were throwing a lot of
they were casting a wide net.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah.
I don't know. Some sort of
the brain health mushrooms. Shot.
Yeah. That with like nootropics and stuff is probably something you shouldn't drink if you're
probably
on medication of any kind.
This is an ad.
But yeah, basically.
We're
Yeah. We're not selling it. But anyway. No. Yeah. So it's future sponsors. Future sponsors of. No, we don't have to talk about the pain.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay.
Also related to this area was an alleged incident in 1924 in which a violent encounter between a group of gold prospectors and a group of quote-unquote ape men had occurred. These allegations were reported in the July 16th, 1924 issue of the
Oregonian.
The Oregonian.
Yes.
And have become a popular piece of Bigfoot lore. And with the area of the the Battle of the Ape Men now being referred to as Ape Canyon.
Come on. The stuff is writing itself.
Trev. It is, honestly. But yeah, Ape Canyon. Honestly, when I wrote this, I said that like, hey, yo, girl, let me see that Ape Canyon. God, and everything ties back to sex again.
Oh,
all right.
Man, we're very compatible in that way. All right, go ahead.
U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt, in his 1893 book, The Wilderness Hunter, writes of a story he was told by an elderly mountain man named Bauman, in which Bauman smelled a foul-smelling bipedal creature and saying that it had ransacked his beaver trapping camp. Jesus. Okay, we don't have to comment on every suggestion.
I'm not commenting. I was just laughing. I'm sorry.
But think about a foul-smelling bipedal creature ransacking your beaver camp or your beaver trapping camp. Yeah, it writes itself, honestly, at this point. We've created the lens to view all of my notes in a terrible light. And I have no one else to apologize to except for Bigfoot. Oh, man.
Beaver camp? Not the beaver camp.
Not beaver trapping.
That's worse. That's worse.
Yeah, honestly.
God damn. Okay.
So
I'm sweating.
The stinky creature basically ransacked his camp, we'll call it, and stalked him and later became hostile when it fatally broke his companion's neck in the wilderness near Idaho-Montana border.
Fuck.
So, like, yeah, just coming upon your friend and he's just got his neck snapped in the woods. Roosevelt notes that Bauman appeared fearful while telling the story, but attributed the trapper's folkloric German ancestry to have potentially influenced him. So I guess, you know, Teddy Roosevelt's like, yeah, this is an interesting story, but I bet you're making it up. So, I don't know if he was a squatcher for life, but at least he you know, entertained the idea. Good on you, Roosevelt. In 1958, Jerry Crew, which was a logging company bulldozer operator in Humboldt County, California, discovered a set of large 16-inch human footprints sunk deep within the mud in the Six River National Forest.
They were human footprints?
That's what he's saying. Like, they're 16 feet long, which is, you know, probably like shack size.
16 inches long.
Yeah.
You said feet.
I said feet. There's too many feet in this episode.
16 feet long.
They were ginormous.
God damn. Imagine the member on that one.
Yeah, that's not Bigfoot size. That's like giant, like skyscraper human size.
So true.
Which is not... I don't want to think about someone's member being like the size of a school bus, but...
Okay. All right.
Anyway, there might be a lot of things to cut out. Anyway, yeah,
this will be a busy one.
There's a lot of imagery that I don't know if I want to give our audience. Upon informing his coworkers, many claimed to have seen similar tracks on previous job sites, as well as telling odd incidences, such as like an oil drum that weighed like 450 pounds having been like moved into a different area without explanation.
Oh.
So they were just like chilling around. They find Big Feet, and then they were like, yeah, remember when that thing moved? That no one could have moved in the middle of the night. So now they're like trying to draw correlations. The logging men soon begin utilizing the term Bigfoot to describe the mysterious culprit. So this is kind of how where the term Bigfoot came, because they found the Bigfoot print, and that's how they referred to as moving all this the shit around.
It was Christian Bale.
Jerry Crew. Yeah, it was Christian Bale in character.
In it.
Jerry Crew, who initially believed someone was playing a prank on them, once again observed more of these numerous massive footprints and contacted a local reporter, Andrew Ginzoli, of the Humboldt Times newspaper. Ginzoli interviewed the lumber workers and wrote articles about the mysterious footprints, introducing the name Bigfoot in relation to the tracks and the local tales of large, hairy, wild men. Which, hairy, wild men, call me.
Heaven! Just kidding.
Yes. I love myself. Plaster cast was made of the footprints, and Crew appeared holding one of the casts. So Jerry was just holding one, smiling ear to ear, like, look, I found these. On the front page of the newspaper in October 6, 1958. So that was kind of like the beginning of Bigfoot being called Bigfoot, because they found Big Feet and they wrote an article. The story spread rapidly as Ginzoli began to receive correspondence from all major media outlets, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times. And as a result, you guessed it, Bigfoot became widespread and referenced to an unknown creature leaving massive footprints in Northern California.
Wow.
A little bit of controversy. In 2002, the family of Crew's deceased coworker Ray Wallace. So the family of a guy that worked with Crew stated that their father had been secretly making the large footprints with large carved wooden feet, and that he was responsible for the tracks. So not Crew himself, but that there was another family that was like, yeah, our granddad did that.
Smells fishy. Joke.
Yeah. Never told anyone. Yeah, funny.
Got you guys.
And despite that, Willow Creek and Humboldt County are considered to be, by some, to be the Bigfoot capital of the world, which is like the northwestern United States, sort of that area. That's definitely where Sasquatch lives. Now, Skunk Apes, different matter. It's like southeastern part.
that's where it gets real humid. It gets real humid down there.
Yeah, in the bayou. Yeah. Just wet Bigfoot all the time. From the humidity. Anyway, according to Live Science, there have been over 10,000 reported Bigfoot sightings in the continental United States. And about one third of all the claims of Bigfoot sightings are located in the Pacific Northwest.
Wow.
And with the remaining reports spread throughout the rest of North America. So 10, there's kind of like 000? A hot spot up there. Yeah.
Wait, period? 10,000 period?
Yeah.
What?
Only 10,000.
That seems low.
Well, it said there has been over 10,000 reported cases. So maybe there's like a million.
Maybe 10,001. Yeah. Well, why would they say 10,000 over 10,000 if it was a fucking million?
I don't know.
Crazy. I hate when they do that. I'm like, give me a closer range. Over 10,007.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know, but that's a lot.
Weird.
To some people and small amounts to others. But still, like, that's a lot of Bigfoot sightings for it to only be like, for it to never have been found, right? Or never have been killed or on all these are alleged cases and all that stuff. So it's still a cryptid. Weird. Some Bigfoot researchers. Some Bigfoot researchers allege that Bigfoot throws rocks as territorial displays and for communications. So if you're ever in the woods and there's just a heckin' rock zoom past you and hit a tree,
heckin' rock,
it's skunk ape.
Wow.
Other alleged behaviors include audible blows struck against trees or the term wood knocking, further alleged to be communicative behaviors. And I have a story. So When I was young, and say like in high school, me and my friends would go into the woods and we would go squatching.
Squatching?
On the weekends. Meaning we would like pack up bags of like snacks and shit and flashlights and whistles and I don't know, all sorts of shit. And we would go out into the woods like behind my friend Tyler's house. And we would just like walk through the woods for like hours until we either came out onto a road or we knew where we were again. Like it would be like a full moon so you could kind of see. And so you wouldn't need your flashlights and stuff. And it would be like in the wintertime. And we just like walk through the woods.
I would say that's like normal childhood stuff, but like girlfriends, where Trevor grew up is fucking wild. Like there's like a lot of shit. It's fucking bobcats.
I mean, it's not like I grew up in like Montana. But yeah, like,
but it's fucking it's the mountains.
Well, I'll say this, like there might be
mountain adjacent.
Where I grew up, there might be like 4 or 5 miles of woods stretch out between house to house. Or neighborhood to neighborhood, if you walk in a certain direction. Otherwise, you know, you'll go like a mile or two through the woods, and you'll end up coming to a road that you could then backtrack to like a stop sign, and you'd be like, "Oh, we're at this intersection." Still. And you'd be like, "All right, cool," and you could get home that way.
I'm telling my future kids right now, no squatching, hell no.
Or we'd like usually leave somebody who had a car back at home. Like just playing video games or something, staying up, doing whatever they wanted. And then we would call them and be like, hey, we're on this road, come pick us up. And then we all jump in.
Have you ever thought about how like it's miraculous that we survived childhood? Like
No. I was very smart.
I think about that all the time.
I would have won.
You're an inherently cautious child, but like you're not a child anymore. I would imagine you were a cautious child.
Yeah. Well,
but like
I was
also very cautious because my mother is super cautious and nervous and like is always like, don't get down from there. Don't do that. Don't be stupid. Don't whatever. Don't, you're going to hurt yourself. Constant. But that's why I'm scared to do things like ice skate, because I'm just like, my mom was always like, you'll break your neck.
as weird as this was, like some of the boys that I was with, like we would go in like groups of like 6 or 5. Yeah. So there was a bunch of us and, you know, we're old enough to where we could probably like help ourselves unless we like walked onto some private property and like got obliterated.
True. That's but, more what I mean about where you grew up. Like that's where you don't realize, like if you walk on someone's
typically land, if someone doesn't want you on their land, there's a fence and then you just don't cross the fence.
Yeah, but they'll sick
or you don't like walk up to someone's backyard unannounced at 2 a.m. But where we were walking, it wasn't necessarily property. But
don't people do, like, aren't people, like, illegally hunting and stuff like that?
Not at night, per se. And not that close, because this was all within the city limits. It wasn't like we were on game land. We would have never walked through game land, because that's basically, like, asking to get shot by a hunter in a tree stand. And it's not that common for someone just to be, like, hunting on random land between, like, housing developments. I don't think that's a thing.
At night?
It could have been. It could be more dangerous. Man, or dangerous. But... Sorry.
More dangerous.
It's hard for me to form words at this point.
Well, man is the most dangerous game.
Yeah, there you go.
Ask Armie Hammer.
Finishing this story, one of the nights that we did it, I told my dad that we were going out. And he was like, you want me to come out there and scare everybody? And I was like, yeah.
Hell yeah.
So he would just go through the woods.
I love your dad.
Behind us or away from us, because we're all like talking. It's very easy to tell exactly where we are in the woods, because we're not like creeping through the woods actually trying to find Sasquatch. We're just like,
you're loud.
We're dicking around. They're just like walking through the woods.
Boys,
trying to be scared. And so my dad would like come behind us and he'd like pick up sticks off the ground and like hit them on trees, like doing the wood knocking thing, because that was something that we had seen on the on TV. And he would just like sit back there and be like, what? Just like make noises, just and I swear, like when we heard that, like we went out of the woods, and my friends for like the next week were like, yeah, it sounded primate in nature. It's definitely it's my dad out there.
Your dad's a fucking troll. He's a fucking troll. He's so awesome.
And I was in on it.
I love him.
which was amazing because I'm just over there.
So funny.
Trying not to giggle because I know it's my dad in the woods. Just
like, and then all of you are trying not to shit your pants for different reasons.
Yeah, I just, if my dad could have just like got on all fours and like galloped through us or something, that would have been fantastic.
Like fucking rain. Sirius Black.
That's terrifying. Sirius Black. Oh no! I thought, yeah, no, Professor, like something looking like Professor Lupin.
Yeah, like the fucking Wendigo.
That's a good way to get like brown pants. Yeah, I'm almost done with my notes. I know we've gotten long winded in this, but this is definitely a but this has been a good cool friends. This has been a good like switch up from the Waco stuff.
Brown pants.
Yeah.
And also a good switch up from, I talked about child trafficking, so.
Yeah. And we're talking about, like, disgusting Bigfoot porn and shit, so. All right. Let's get through this. Let's see. However, experts, basically, the wood knocking and the throwing of rocks is one thing, but many alleged sightings were reported to occur at night, leading to some speculations that the creature may possess nocturnal tendencies, which when we would go out, it was always at night. But experts find such behavior as they find it untenable in a supposed ape or like human-like creature, as all known apes, including humans, are diurnal, which means that like only lesser primates exhibit true nocturnality. So like humans are typically like we go to bed at night, wake up and during the day and all that. So it didn't make sense why Sasquatch, who is like a greater ape concept thing, would be purely nocturnal. Alleged vocalizations, as far as like what Bigfoot sounds like, alleged vocalizations are as follows: howls. Yeah, pretty spooky. Screams, just like a big throaty scream or throaty moan. Moans, grunts, whistles, and even a form of supposed language have been reported and allegedly reported. Some people out there with their camcorders getting some moans and grunts. Like, I don't know how.
Was that good? That a good Chewy impression?
Yeah. Oh, Matt.
No, that's.
I don't know what that is. That could be Sasquatch.
How about that?
It sounds like Sasquatch. We got him.
We found him. Okay, go.
You need to quit making those noises, or Bigfoot might come and knock on your door.
That's true.
You don't know what you're saying.
Like, ooh, lady Squatch.
Yeah, you don't know what you're saying.
You don't know what you're saying.
So, in 2007, the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization put forth photos which they stated showed a juvenile Bigfoot. However, the Pennsylvania Game Commission stated that the photos were of a bear with mange. And so there's a photo on the drive for number B. And this is kind of the things that, these are kind of the examples of what people send in, not knowing that it's like animal in nature.
I don't like that one.
And that, like, mainstream crazy scientists, you don't like it?
Where was that?
Pennsylvania.
Trevor, that makes me nauseous.
Do you like it?
No, I hate it.
Can you describe to the cool friends what
it looks like? A chimpanzee is how I would describe it. Like, all hairy, but it's on all fours and it's just kind of like next to a tree.
It's facing away from me, right?
Facing away from you. And it looks like someone took this like through a bush. Like they like
Well, I think it's like a trail cam. Have you ever seen trail cam footage?
Yeah.
It's not a good trail cam either.
No. Someone took this on their LG chocolate. That's insane. LG
chocolate.
Right,
but the reason why I'm showing this is because they say that it was of a juvenile bear with mange.
Fuck that.
So that's, that it's like bear. It's that's lanky not, it's not as like thick as a bear. You don't think it's a bear?
This is fucking rural Pennsylvania, and I have to say, It's more likely that it's a fucking chimpanzee than it's a fucking bear with mange. Look at that thing. Mange? Yeah. Isn't that a skin thing?
Yeah, mange? Meaning it was patchy hair. It's not a full coat.
Yeah, but why are its back legs straight? Have you ever seen a bear walk like that? Or with its back hunched? It looks like it's not girthy enough to be a bear, you know?
Yeah, it's a young bear. It's lanky. He hasn't really grown into his bear form.
I don't buy it. No.
But that's also something that people were saying, that Bigfoot sightings could also be people who either escaped zoo animals, apes from an escape zoo, chimpanzees from an escape zoo.
Yeah.
Or people having these exotic private animals that just escape into the woods.
This is in 2007.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much LG chocolate days.
It was. I had an LG chocolate slide. It was an awesome phone.
LG chocolate slide sounds disgusting. Several things that have happened where humans have been mistaken for Bigfoot, with some incidents leading to injuries. In 2013, a 21-year-old man in Oklahoma was arrested after he told law enforcement that he accidentally shot his friend in the back while their group was allegedly hunting for Bigfoot. So good thing we didn't walk in through guns. The woods armed to the teeth.
Yeah.
That'd have been bad.
Yeah, they're just asking for it. Would you not say, if you're hunting for Sasquatch with weapons, with your friends at night, you're not asking to shoot someone? That says someone is getting shot in that scenario. I don't know what other way that could go. Because
being
one
around
of them
people with firearms and they're scared.
And they just fucking get shot in the face.
He's over there. Get him. Just unloading an ungodly amount of rounds into my dad.
Oh. Call your dad.
Call your dad, cool friends. He could be out trying to scare preteens in the woods.
If he is, you call us, because that's the case.
We'll do a case on it. We want to have him on. But yes, so people have been mistaken for Bigfoot. Bears have been mistaken for Bigfoot. People say that escaped zoo animals have been mistaken. There's also a cool, I don't know if this is psychology, but it may just be something scientific, but some scientists have proposed that pareidolia, it's pareidolia, may explain Bigfoot sightings, specifically
pareidolia, the parietal lobe. That's my guess.
I think so.
Yeah.
Specifically the tendency to observe human-like faces and figures within the natural environment.
I've heard of that.
In reality, there aren't any. Yeah. It's also how people look at the front of cars and they see faces or one example was the Danish electrical outlet. It's two circles and a semicircle, which kind of looks a smiley face.
Yeah, but I think it's different than that. I think it's those people who find that it's they see a human face.
Find Jesus on their toes.
It's not. Yeah, it's not a smiley face. This is the Jesus toast people and the potato chip, the Jesus potato chip people.
Or Elton John's in my latte or something.
Elton John's in my latte. Yeah.
Yeah. This is also closely tied to the man on the moon thing.
Yeah.
Or people seeing a rabbit in the moon.
Let me see. Pareidolia.
Which is specifically called lunar pareidolia.
Specific, often meaningful image. Oh, so it's not just human faces.
No.
It's a meaningful image in random, make pictures out of randomness.
Right. It's there could be an object, a specific object they see, or a pattern. If you're that cloud looks like a bunny rabbit or something. But that's basically what they're saying is any Bigfoot encounters that people are seeing from far off, it could just be instances of pareidolia where they're thinking that they're seeing Bigfoot but really they're not. It's just patterns or objects that give them the impression their brain jumps to Bigfoot, probably because they want to believe it.
Anyway,
it's interesting. But that's all I have
on
Bigfeet.
Wow, that was a good one.
That was a fun one. I like that one.
Yeah, that was lots of laughs. Yeah. I have to cut like 90% of that shit out, I feel like.
Nah, I'll leave it in. Why not?
Well, maybe about the ape canyons.
Cool, friends. Yeah. This is the end of the episode. This is the end of the episode where we all fall apart and struggle on how to format an ending.
Wait, you know what we should do?
What should we do?
You know how in The Office, that episode where it's Kelly's birthday and Dwight decorates with the banner that says, "It is your birthday," period?
Mm.
Maybe we should just say, "This is the end."
This is the end.
This is the end. Not yet, though. We have to plug our socials.
Oh, okay.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah. You can reach us via email at wheremurdermeetsmystery@gmail.com. Or what, Grace?
You can follow us on Instagram at wheremurdermeetsmystery. Send us a DM. Give us a case request, please. Or a mystery or a conspiracy or cryptid. Cool, friends. We love you. We love you so much.
Yes,
this
we do.
This is the end.
This is the end.
Goodbye.
Anyway, love you. Bye.